Welcome to The Roundup, where we tackle big health topics from the outback to the tropics. I'm your host, Alyssa Hatherley, a local GP and head of James Cook University's Clinical School in Mackay. In each episode, you'll hear from experienced clinicians sharing expert insights on key regional health issues, best practice approaches, and practical strategies to improve patient care in regional and rural settings. Before we begin, I'd like to respectfully acknowledge the Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, their contributions to healthcare, and the traditional owners of the lands in which we practice and provide education.
Yiridu Marung, you and Nadi Sarah Jane Springer, Dira Madalinya Badu Wiradjuri, Baladan Nanyul Mudji, Nati Bapan Colin Gibbons, Dari Wuranya, Nati Bapan Bal Toss Gibbons, Dari Wuranya. Toss Gibbons Babin Thomas Gibbons. Ninya Gulia Wiradjuri. Natu Yindamalija Nati Mudigang. Natu Yindamaraja Nati Nurumbang. Nati Wunanga Durunya Nati Mudigangbu Nurumbangbu. Nina Nati Gira Gira. Yindamara. Wunangana. Bala Wuluwin. Marangu. So I'd like to acknowledge country. Acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we are speaking across today and pay respects to the elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
In today's episode, I'm joined by Drs. Shannon Springer and Dr. Sarah Jane Springer. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's really exciting to be able to talk about developing culturally safe spaces with a couple of clinicians who identify as First Nations practitioners. Thanks very much for being here to talk about this. It's a really difficult space, I think, for clinicians to try and navigate a culturally safe workplace for patients and for colleagues. But I think you want to remind us today that it's not that difficult to achieve. Is that right, Shannon?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this conversation around developing culturally safe spaces has been happening for some time. And I guess, you know, in the past, it shouldn't have been as difficult as it probably was made out to be, because there are some really easy steps that we can all implement on the ground to ensure that our patients feel culturally safe, and also the staff. It could be our registrars, because there are a lot more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people coming through medical school and into, hopefully into general practice and community care. So this is going to be a really important thing that hopefully is just going to become a normal part of the way we practice medicine and developing culturally safe spaces for everyone.
So I guess we start with the definition, I think, about what is cultural safety in terms of what we're talking about today. So culturally safe practices. Let's put a definition on how that is actually defined for our community.
So I guess the whole term around cultural safety was developed and coined by a Māori nurse in the late 80s or 90s. Her name was Ramsden. But she deliberately used the word safety because it's a very subjective term. Like only the patient or only the client can determine whether someone's actually safe or not. We actually can't do it for them. So it's very subjective, and it was deliberately picked for that reason. So I think that explains the whole concept. So we can't define that. Only our patients in the community can define if they're culturally safe. So we need to think about how we actually measure that as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll come to that later on.
So what would be some of the first practical steps that we could take in our practices, guys?
Sure. So I guess, you know, we're all living across different communities, and every community is equally, you know, is different. You know, if you've been to one community, you've only been to one community. And I was talking to Sarah about that because she's just recently moved to Mackay, and we're talking about ways how she can get to know the local community. And I guess that brings us to our first step is try and engage with your local community and identify your partners. So whether, you know, you're working in a town where there is an Aboriginal medical service, obviously they'll be a partner. Are there any other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations that might be able to be a partner or that you may refer to, particularly around you know, in every, you know, across every sector, housing, education, in the hospital sector, there'll be an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person working in some area. So understanding who your allies are in terms of your, you know, community partnerships is a really important place to start, and getting to know your local community, particularly before, you know, you go out and have those conversations and sort of establish yourself on the scene.
So starting with engaging our local partners, and then what do we do after that?
Once we do have good partnerships with people, it gives us an opportunity to actually understand what culturally safe spaces look like for the community. So my second thing is developing culturally safe places in the places in which we work. So I'll give you an example. At one time of my career, I actually was a partner in a private general practice. And being an Aboriginal person and working in this particular places, I wanted to engage more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in my practice. So when walking into the waiting room, you know, you could see it was quite sterile. There were some very generic posters and pictures up, but there was no local Aboriginal art. So what I did on my own back is engaged a local artist, a local Aboriginal artist, to tell the story about the place at which we work. And I went into the practice one night, removed a couple of things at the demise of some of the people working there, and hung that large piece of art in the waiting room. And it was a massive conversation starter. So basically throughout that, you know, throughout the first, I think in the first 6 months, I think we were able to identify existing patients on the system who were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, just because we hung a piece of artwork that was done by a local Aboriginal artist. So it provided a space where people could talk about their Aboriginality. And this is the power of transforming the settings in which you work.
Language is another important factor in that as well. I think that when signage and symbols go along with other visual sort of representation of mob, that can be really powerful too. And I reflect on a personal scenario when my father was quite unwell and was palliative back home, and being able to go back to the hospitals in my country and have your own words be present for pharmacy or at the palliative care ward or, you know, a hospital overall, I think that provides a sense of safety and a sense of pride in your culture too. So I really felt a lot of joy and comfort, I guess, in feeling as though that those spaces were becoming more culturally safe because they were representing what was something that was very important to myself and to my family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just picking up on that point as well. So you can think about it as what are the structural things that we need to change? And those were like the physical environments in which we work. And I guess what you're talking about is more of the touches where we can actually provide better communication, engagement, and provide better access to culturally appropriate healthcare. Mm. And so, you know, the challenge is in our current spaces, you know, how do we identify the barriers for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to accessing better healthcare? And those barriers are going to be different for different communities. And it's something really important to actually reflect on.
I know there's an example in one of the hospitals in which they bring through a local elder to come through and do a walkthrough on, you know, somewhat regular occurrences. And it's basically up to one or two elders to identify whether or not they feel that they are represented in the rooms in which they're walking through. So, you know, can they sit there and see their country being represented on the walls, in language, in the systems and processes, in the way in which they have to navigate from a patient journey perspective. So I think that's a really good way to remain culturally safe from a community perspective, which again goes back to the definition of cultural safety, and have a true marker of whether or not the organisation or the health service are actually leading the way or demonstrating what they're hoping to demonstrate when it's confirmed by local people.
Mm, absolutely. And just picking up on that really important point that you make is that, you know, as we know, cultural safety is determined by the people that we're providing care for. So training our staff in our physical environment is really important. So providing cultural safety training, and that cultural safety training will look different for different people in your organisation or in the practice that you work. So what's provided for the receptionist, the nurses, the doctors, you know, the practice manager is going to look different for different people depending on what area they're working with. So for the doctor space, there are some good resources developed by the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association, taking people from cultural awareness, understanding cultural difference, towards that journey of being more culturally safe. So there are a lot of resources out there, and hopefully we can provide some links to those later on.
Yeah, we can pop those links in the podcast notes, Shannon. That's no drama. So providing culturally safe spaces for our patients, you've talked about engaging with the local community so we can identify the partners, and then, of course, asking those partners about how we can reflect cultural safety in our physical spaces, but then also in the language that we're using and those non-physical communication cues that you've mentioned, and then providing formal training for the staff that is appropriate for the position that those staff members work in. So what do we do next?
Alyssa, I probably have another example to add on to that list that you've really concisely summarised. Another example is they have basically their chaperones in some ways. I don't know the better way to term them, but I think it's a Cairns hospital where every patient is actually greeted by an Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander representative as they come through the door to assist with that whole patient journey process. And there are some research and some evidence around that to suggest that people are more likely to not discharge against medical advice or actually stay for the course of being able to be seen to treatment. I don't have those papers right on hand at this moment, but I'm sure that we could dig them up and put them in the resource notes as well. But I think that's another practical example of a strengths-based approach to improving cultural safety in our practices that is making a massive difference and making our patients feel a lot more comfortable in foreign systems, which they aren't used to really transgressing through at times.
Oh, so yeah. Like a concierge service. That concierge, sounds like
yes.
A fantastic idea. I love
yes,
it.
Sorry, I said chaperone, but I'm like, oh, no, concierge, that's exactly the term.
Yeah, right. So they're things that we can definitely look to engage with our partners with in community practice, because that might be hard to achieve, but certainly in our hospital settings, that would be a fantastic service to offer.
Yeah, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. And I guess just coming back to our next point, which I think is really important to bring up, the third point is understanding what trauma-informed care is, particularly, you know, as healthcare providers. So it's really recognising those historical, you know, past policies and history that's really helped, that's actually shaped the experience for a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the communities. So understanding trauma-informed care really can help us approach and prioritise that cultural safety and the trust, and help create more supportive environments where people actually feel empowered, particularly around healing and well-being. And the other reason why I bring that up is that, you know, when we look at health promotion, it's not disease prevention. So how do we protect good health, and how do we build those things around patients where we can use culture as a strength? So having a strength-based approach to the past historical policies and trauma that might have been transgenerational, I think is really important and really powerful. And for clinicians, I think it's a really important skill that we can have, and we can apply that to other cultures, and we can apply that to our other patients as well, as understanding their context and their lived experiences.
You make that sound so easy, Shannon. How do we actually do that in practical terms?
Well, I guess it depends where you are in your cultural safety journey. So everyone's got a different starting point. So, you know, it depends where people are. So, you know, ensuring that you understand the fundamental principles around cultural safety, and then being able to apply it to practice. And then there are a lot of resources, and there is training around cultural informed care and how you can actually do that in a meaningful way, and help unpack that patients. But also, like I said at the start, is that there will be people that are out there that can actually, you know, depending on their trauma and what their experiences are, there will be Aboriginal Torres Strait health workers and, you know, psychologists that you can help refer people to. So understanding your partners around this, and then growing your sense of self as well, is really important.
Okay. Now, Shannon and Sarah-Jane Springer, do you have any last advice for those of us wanting to improve cultural safety for our patients and our other clients in whatever the circumstance are, and of course our First Nations colleagues?
Yeah, look, I just in closing, I think there are a few things. There are guidelines out there specifically for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in terms of health promotion, disease prevention. So understanding the guidelines, but they're guidelines. So really, those guidelines should be applied to the community in which we're living and working and embedded in. So these are things that you can apply, not as a standard thing for every single Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patient, but you can apply it in real context because, you know, you're a clinician and you should, you know, we should be able to be at that level where we know where to use these guidelines appropriately. So understanding the health promotion and disease prevention guidelines that are there is really important.
And I think lastly, I don't think there's ever a lastly in terms of the trajectory of cultural awareness to cultural safety, but another thing that we can practically encourage people to do is continuous quality improvement. And what that might look like from a practice perspective is when you have your practice meetings is also to ensure that the policies that you have, that the guidelines that, like Shannon was talking about, have privileged First Nations voices and also are co-designed and had heavy consultation with community, because it's not until those avenues and those processes are achieved that we can really hand on heart say that we are actually applying cultural safety in the way that which it is defined. So going right back to the beginning, it can only be defined by those in which it's been enacted upon. It's very subjective, and it's one of those things that we need to continue to assess from a quality and safety perspective if we're actually doing that right. So what that looks like is collecting feedback from First Nations patients, engaging in reflective practice, and implementing changes based on the community input so that we can always continue to have those quality improvement drives. So, you know, I've been doing a bit of work with A Better Culture recently and looking at improving the training pathway essentially for our young medical trainees and reducing their experiences around bullying, harassment, discrimination and racism, and what that might look like from a systems transformative change perspective, which is slightly different again, and love to circle back and talk about that in a bit more length. But that looks at really embedding co-design and consultation into the way in which we develop our systems. They need to be built for our people, not just as a bolt-on, add-on type initiative, because that's where we've been going wrong, I think, for a long period of time. And what that looks like is having strong cultural governance. That's another topic we can talk about another time. But essentially, bringing it back to continuous quality improvement, I think, is really important as well for us to practically assess ourselves and how we're going, making sure that we're making positive steps towards a better future for our people.
Sarah Jane Springer and Shannon Springer, thank you so much for your time today. I think that sounds like the right moment to stop this conversation so that we can reflect really critically on our own practice and where we can make those improvements. You've given us some really practical steps that we can follow. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you. Marangul.
For more information about the Roundup, or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only, and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline, and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.